welcome to another episode of the Miles Podcast. This is your host, Stephen Miller. This week we have Dr. Kristen Brogard on here, and she is going to let us know what she does and how she got involved with reproductive medicine. So welcome, Kristen.
Hi, Stephen. Great to connect. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I know it's kind of been back and forth a little bit, but finally able to connect and nail down a time. And so for our listeners, like, what is it that you actually do in reproductive medicine?
Yeah, great question. So I am co-founder and chief scientific officer at Inherent Biosciences. And at Inherent, we are entirely focused raising the standard of care in male reproductive health. So our goal is to drive innovation in the male fertility, infertility, and all other reproductive health areas, because, as we'll probably talk about on this episode, there is a lot lacking in the space. So we are trying to drive it forward and bring more awareness to the public about male reproductive health. How I got into it, you know, I got into it from a kind of a different angle. I did my doctorate and postdoctorate work focused on technology development, personalized technology development, specifically in the field of epigenetics, which is a field of how your DNA, your genes are expressed. Had my first startup out in Seattle. It was a great company, and then had the opportunity to move out to Utah and wanted to start a new company out in Utah, and was very serendipitously introduced to my co-founder, who had started doing research in gamete, or specifically sperm and egg epigenetics, and saw a lot of opportunity to improve the space by using a new technology. And it was something that I was, you know, passionate about epigenetics. But when I started to dig into the science specifically on male reproductive health, I was totally blown away of the lack of innovation in the space, and blown away that, you know, looking at, especially in fertility, the whole focus is on the female, but 50% is due to the male. So why haven't we made more progress than what we have? So I thought it was a great opportunity to utilize my scientific knowledge and my entrepreneurial experience to really focus on an area that needs improvement.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in the, like, the general public realize how much there is a lack of research when it comes to male fertility issues. I was first introduced to that when I had read
Renee Almeling's book, you know, Gynecology, The Missing Science of Reproductive Health for Men. And as a man, I didn't even realize that. Like, there was such a lack of research compared to the research that has been done by OBGYNs from, you know, years ago. And I thought Renee did an excellent job of, like, looking at it. And there was an infographic about, like, the amount of research. And it was just, like, maybe, like, a centimeter. And then, like, the amount of research for women.
Exactly right.
And, you know, it got me thinking. And, like, it's like, how much do you think that lack of research has to do with the idea and the narrative that we've grown up with or over the years and perpetuated, that woman, like, fertility is a woman's issue? And to me, it makes sense that culturally, if you believe that, that's where the research would go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think there's a general understanding, and there still is, despite increasing of research, that fertility is a female issue. I think some of that was driven, there was a bit of patriarchy in the sciences for quite a bit of time. And so there was, you know, thoughts that sperm, there's nothing wrong with sperm, the guys are fine, it's all focused on the women. So there was that type of sentiment. But also, for a really long time, the egg was considered and is very complex. And because there's implantation and then development, rightfully so, until we were able to dig into it more, there was this assumption that the complexity of fertility was really due to the complexity of the egg, the needs for embryo development, implantation, and then gestation. You know, that's largely associated with the female. And it's not until really the last decade or so where there's been some significant research showing that sperm are not just little tanks with DNA in it, and their only job is to get DNA to the egg, which is what was originally thought. It's actually a very, very complex system of development of the sperm, what's in the sperm head, and then fertilization. And then also components of the sperm inside the sperm head are necessary for embryo development and implantation. So that's just been very recent. And so I think there's been a recent appreciation for the complexity of sperm, largely because of that narrative that we've been told for so long. There's a focus on the female. And I do want to add, there's still this narrative that men can help impregnate at any age. And we do know that a man can be fertile for long periods of time, but their fertility is really, really affected with age. And because when a female reaches menopause, they become infertile, that also fed into the narrative that age and the female age as being the most important part.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that recently have heard as well, is just like the paternal effects as, men get older. I mean, if you think about it, in general, people this same day and age are having children later in life. I think I saw like a statistic where I think in 1970, the average age of the first time mother was 21.
Where in 2019, it's 27. You know, I'm talking about 6 years, that's a tremendous amount of time. And think about as sperm quality decline, like how that contributes, to like the genetic makeup and birth defect. And it's not just from the woman. It takes two to make a baby. Yeah. So
there's very strong research linking paternal age to recurrent miscarriages, failure at IVF cycles, and then also offspring developmental issues. So it's definitely a huge factor that should not get ignored.
Yeah, for sure. So I know initially, like we were talking about male factor. What do you see as maybe like not necessarily all the people, like what are like issues with the current male fertility testing, and what do you
things that with current testing that are good, or like are there things that are maybe things that need to be worked upon?
That makes total sense. So gold standard right now for male reproductive infertility testing is the standard semen analysis. This essentially looking into a microscope, counting how many sperm are there, seeing how they're swimming, and looking at the shape. So that's the gold standard. And in most cases, that's the only thing guys get. I think the issue with that is, to my point before, sperm is very complex. And the semen analysis is only looking at essentially a snapshot of how they look externally. So there are lots of things, and we know men who have normal semen parameters are still struggling to have a baby, and there's no other female concerns. So we know we're missing a lot for identifying subfertility in men. And I think Dr. Barrett Cowan at Posterity Health put it in a really, really good way when I was first getting into this field. He said, the semen analysis is like looking at like a USPS map of all the trucks or all the delivery cars with packages and mail. And you can see where they're going, you can see how many there are, but what you're missing is what's inside the trucks. Are the packages damaged? Are the envelopes ripped? So you're really getting a snapshot of the larger picture, but not looking molecularly. So I think, the main issue is that we're not taking into account the complexity of sperm and the complexity of the entire fertilization process. There are new technologies coming out that are bringing molecular biology and understanding gene functions and genetic stability into the market. And that's helping get a larger picture of capturing more men who are infertile than the semen analysis. At Inherent Biosciences, we have created a novel test called Sperm Quality Test, or Sperm QT. And this is a test where we get a semen sample, we isolate the sperm from the semen sample, crack open the head, extract the DNA, and analyze the gene function of over 1,200 genes in the sperm. So this is something we can see, are the genes that are necessary for a sperm to be a sperm functioning properly? And we have data showing that if the function isn't normal, it affects IUI outcomes. So this is just another way to get more deep and understand sperm parameters and how to assess subfertility. But sperm QT has been an amazing addition, but because male infertility is so complex, we need a lot more tests. Just like for female infertility, there's a ton of different ways to look at, you know, are you ovulating? Do you have any blockage? Do you have any endometriosis, PCOS? All these tests are necessary for female fertility. We need the same like 360 view of male fertility. So there's definitely room for even more improvement.
So I know from my own experience, done a number of, you know, sperm analysis, but I also remember doing DNA fragmentation testing.
Yeah.
But to be honest, like I, even when I did it, I had no idea what it even did. I just like, you tell me if it's good or bad then, but like, what is that? You know, like what is the DNA fragmentation test? What is that looking for?
Yeah. So DNA fragmentation test came out maybe about 20 years ago. And what it looks at is chromosomal stability. So it actually looks at double-stranded or single-stranded breaks in your DNA. It doesn't really have to do with gene function. It has to do with the stability of your chromosomes.
Yeah.
And it has been implicated that if you have too many breaks in your DNA, that's associated with recurrent pregnancy loss. So men or couples who are seeing recurrent pregnancy loss and there aren't female factors that seem to be in play are recommended for DNA fragmentation to assess if that is the issue. And the course of action, if they see that there's a lot of chromosomal breaks in DNA fragmentation, is what's called a testicular extraction of sperm. So you can aspirate sperm out of the testicle, and sperm in the testicle showed less fragmentation than ejaculated sperm. Exactly. So that, and then they would use that for IVF with ICSI.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, like I said, like I know that they were
doing that, but I'm like, you know, at that point, like when you're in the journey, you're just like, do whatever you need to do. Like, it's like, if you think it's going to make things work, then you never like question it really.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I do want to make the point too, for this initial assessment of subfertility, we know that the semen analysis misses a lot of men and they are not diagnosed as subfertile. And it's really important to understand that when men go undiagnosed and they're considered fertile, the female partner is subjected to procedures and treatments that aren't going to work. And it leads to a longer time to baby and even more money than just jumping straight to a procedure that will work. So it's really, really crucial in the fertility journey to diagnose and identify subfertility as early on as possible.
So I was just going to ask you if that was going to be like the main
reason why you're thinking about like the sperm QT is just the timeline. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So sperm QT works best when it's done in the initial assessment of the male alongside the semen analysis. And together, those two can be way more predictive of identifying subfertile men than just the semen analysis alone. We found extreme significant clinical value by doing it upfront. And then once you identify male factor earlier on, the doctor can understand the best treatments forward to, you know, to reach a baby in a timeline that is, you know, acceptable for the couple.
So I know, like, historically, at least with states that have mandated coverage,
and usually the gold standard is like you try so many IUIs first and then you do IVF. I know when our original talks, you were talking about how a lot of times, like if we had this quality test bypassing IUI instead of having to basically force a couple into doing that, knowing that it may or may not work. And IUIs in general, I think the percentages of it working are small. Because the way that insurance operates nowadays, right, they get to dictate like what tests and everything like that. I just want to know like what your thoughts on that, like with insurance, like having that gold standard of IUIs. And then like this, like almost being like a candidate, right? So like if we do this test, then we can bypass that. It's one of your thoughts, especially with the insurance piece. Yeah.
Yeah, the insurance piece is so important. So when men are diagnosed as infertile clinically, then you actually can bypass the IUI and insurance accepts that. So if you have that early diagnosis, you're able to bypass the mandated three IUIs to get to the procedure that will work, which is IVF with ICSI in most cases when there's when there's subfertility. We're currently talking to insurance companies, big and small. There's some really great insurance companies that are fertility focused that are working with corporations for employee care like Progyny and Wynn and Carrot that we're talking to see if we can integrate this into their diagnosis of subfertility in men. But it's a great question, and for, insurance really dictates for couples how their process is going. So we would need this to be a diagnosis for subfertility.
Yeah. So I would imagine the men that maybe have
normal semen parameters that are subfertile that we don't know because we haven't looked deeper into that, like that would still be like a barrier. I also just think about like the mental and the psychological toll that takes, you know, of having to do three IUIs not working, you know, and how that is really impacts a couple's psychological and mental health.
It's brutal. I mean, it's painful. There's an emotional toll. It's frustrating. It's a pretty horrible process. And the dropout rate of couples, there's a paper that came out of Boston IVF several years ago that said the dropout rate was like 66% from when start that didn't even end up having a child because the burden and the emotional toll was so impactful.
Yeah.
So this would, I mean, so we can get to those couples and identify a male factor earlier on, you're not going to have that. It's still a really intense journey, but you will be able to bypass those procedures that just add extra to the burden.
So I know we kind of talked about this in like in the dearth of research, you know, and understanding male fertility. How else would you explain besides like the narrative? Because part of it, I think, is men's egos. I mean, let's be final about it. Like the men's egos,
it's like it's not my issue. It's, you know, somebody else. And I think part of it too was like the focus is that they can visibly see like the pregnant woman, she's carrying the child, and see where the emphasis being put on research because like you, at the end result, you want to have a live child at the end. But it's also crazy to me that even nowadays, and this was even just last year, I had a coworker of mine who was in her 30s, did not even know that male infertility existed.
And Mike, how do you not
know that this doesn't exist? You know, besides narrative, do you think that there's other factors that kind of come into play with like the lack of knowledge about like male infertility?
Absolutely. It's definitely improved. There are large corporations who are kind of getting into the space. Roman is one of them. So talking about having a conversation, they're getting into male fertility. So there's been larger groups trying to educate the public, but there is a huge lack of public education on the subject. And I think it goes to your exact point. Like there is an ego issue here, and that comes into play a lot of times. We actually have heard that men are not even willing to do the semen analysis while doing their, you know, going through their fertility treatment, which is just horrifying and heartbreaking that that's the case. So there is this ego associated with it where, you know, it's not me, I'm perfect. And sperm is a very private thing for men. And it's so to have that, and it's so linked to vitality and virality, so it's very linked to like kind of the core, some of the core stuff that men are taught to be important. So I think it's just going to take a lot of time and more education. And there is definitely a difference in some of the new generations of people coming along. I mean, just the fact that we're talking about male birth control is a really big issue, and men are now involved in the birth control discussions with their partners. So that wasn't the case 20 years ago. So there's definitely a change, and we just need to keep going at it and educating that this is a concern.
Yeah. To me, I've always been
a huge proponent, and always will be like a huge proponent for like introducing all this stuff at the post-secondary level of colleges. Like this is their careers, right? I mean, people like whether that's biology, whether that's genetics, that's mental health, like that's social work, counseling, psychology, anything that goes into the IVF process, like, should be introducing this as a career field. Because I had seen on LinkedIn, maybe about a month ago, somebody posted an article about the shortage of embryologists. And if they don't know that infertility exists, they're not going to know that this is a career field. And from, at least from my anecdotal evidence, it's like most men, at least, don't realize male fertility exists until they're diagnosed. And that's their 30s, right? Usually their 30s or 40s, maybe, like, by the time that they understand who's going back to school to do that. I think that's why we have a lot of mental health professionals that end up focusing on this because they already have the degree, they can use it. Yeah, there's a lot more, you know, that needs to be done at the, like I said, whether it's graduate or undergrad education to bring awareness.
Yeah, I totally agree. And something, a really important point there is that there's increasing evidence, and I think I've heard you mention this before, Stephen, that fertility, male fertility and semen quality is linked to overall health. There's tons of evidence that there's a correlation between semen parameters and long-term health outcomes. And that's because, you know, that's just a window into men's health is their semen quality. And it's really the first time that they've been analyzed. Like, you know, they're not going to the doctor and getting blood checks. That's really the first time they've been analyzed, and they see it, and it shows through their fertility potential. So I feel like not only do we need to educate about it in our schools, but we need to start bringing male reproductive health earlier into a young man's life. Like a female is going to the doctor continually, their OB-GYN, when they're 12, 13 years old. Why are we not doing that with men? And because there's a lot of things you can do to improve your semen quality. And then also it's really good for tracking longer term health outcomes. It's an important point. And we actually are running a clinical trial right now. We have this group of young men with no known fertility issues as a control arm. And actually two of the guys at 19 years old had zero sperm. So they found out as trying to, you know, being part of a control study that they didn't have any sperm in their semen. But they wouldn't have found that out until they were in their 30s and trying to conceive. So it's something that we identified way earlier for these men so that they could know that it's something that they should be thinking about longer term and understanding the causes of it.
Right. Because I interviewed a guy with Klinefelter's, and if anyone knows anything about Klinefelter's, like, the symptoms are not very upfront. I mean, they're very vague. I mean, they're very subtle things. And he grew up thinking he was just a normal, you know, guy, and he had just different quirks. And I would recommend people, if you listen back to that episode, like, it was definitely very insightful. But he didn't find out that he had Klinefelter's until he was in his 30s. You know, it's like, that's how many years did he wait to, like, now this all makes sense of why, like, I am the way I am. And, you know, Klinefelter is like, there's zero. Like, they ended up using sperm donation and they went that path. But it's not a hard thing. You know, like, doing it, you know, it's, I mean, I get it to a point, like, of where some people are, it is tied, you know, like, your men's fertility is often societally tied to, like, masculinity and virility. And I can't be me, like, you know, and, like, there's just that thought that, like, oh, if I'm producing what I'm supposed to produce and I'm good, like, that means this is what it's working. And, you know, both you and I know, like, that's not all that there is to it. There's way more. And there's more research that needs to be done as well. I even think about, like, men with their subfertile sperm counts. Why is it that some men have low sperm counts? Because I think from a male perspective, like, and things that I thought of is, like, why is my count low? And when you have that ambiguity, you kind of go down paths of, like, was it medication that I took when I was a kid? Was it that one time that I did this, or one time I did that? Is it my dad? You know, like, there's so many things that can spiral out of that. Like, and even nowadays, like, I still question, like, why? Like, why was it low? Like, why is it consistently low? And there are no answers to that. So I'm hoping at some point in our lives, like, that we will have answers of, like, why it is, you know, like, that you have, like, some men that have low sperm counts, some of them that don't have any. So I think being able to provide answers for people, I think, is going to be a great thing.
And that's a great point. And so for we actually are doing some research to understand the causes of some of these concerns, especially of azoospermia, which is men with no sperm. Mm-hmm. So for your opinion, Stephen, is it important for you to know the cause if you can't change it?
I don't know. I mean, I think we were successful. So I think that's probably a big factor of why, like, it's not so much an issue, like, for me now, because, like, I've had that success. And to me, even, like, with this podcast and the other things I do, it has kind of given me a renewed purpose, you know, like, and doing something with, like, that experience of our IVF journey and the things that the hoops that we had to jump through and everything. So I think at a point of right now, like, does it occasionally cross my mind? Yes. But is it, like, a primary objective for me? No. But if you would have said to me in the middle of it, in the beginning, the possible causes, I probably would have wanted to know.
Right.
Like, if it was something like, yeah, I mean, just even having a concrete answer of, like, why is my count low? Like I said, I think that if we were not successful, that might be a different question. You know, yeah. I might have a different answer to that.
It's a great point. Just your experience within the journey. And then since you've been successful, your mindset's a little different. That is something we are always thinking about, is finding the causes, but understanding how important that is to somebody to know it and how that affects somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like I said, it's different, like, when you're facing it up front compared to 2-3 years past of, like, you've had your, you know, success. Yeah. That's a good question though. I mean, cause yeah, it's like, is it really worth knowing, like, the causes, like, if it's going to impact you? So one of the last questions, and I know, like, we really, I mean, touched upon it kind of throughout, but can maybe as a final, like, wrap up, is, like, what do you see as the most prevalent issues regarding, like, male infertility? And I guess even putting a plug in for, like, sperm QT, like, and how that will impact.
Yeah, I have actually two answers for that. Am I allowed to?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So the first is, it's been pretty well publicized, the huge decline in male fertility over the last 20, 40 years is something that we really need to recognize. Looking specifically at semen parameters and sperm count, there's been a 50% decrease in sperm concentration since 1974. And that is shocking.
Yeah.
So there's a huge issue, and it's, you know, worldwide. There's a very, very big issue here. Now WHO has updated their numbers that 1 in 6 couples are experiencing infertility. So just over the last 10 years, those numbers have just increased. There's so many people struggling. And there is, you know, there's increasing of age of couples, like you mentioned earlier, but also male infertility is really getting hit. And there's data out there. I think it's multifactorial what's happening, but there is data out there suggesting that environmental exposures, toxins, pesticides, more of the Western diet with exposures in your meats and your vegetables, as well as sedentary lifestyle, all of that combined potentially could be causing this. So I think it's a really important thing to mention that there's a huge issue going on right now. And then in addition to that, we are measuring semen parameters right now of concentration, motility, morphology of your sperm. But there is a very dramatic need to improve our diagnostics and therapeutics in male fertility. Like, it is very lacking. It's rudimentary. And so you know, we are trying to help alleviate that and solve some of the issues by adding new molecular technologies to the field, which will identify more subfertile men than the semen analysis. Because there's huge inequity in the fertility journey, as we talked about. If we can start to understand the role of the male better and start to identify subfertility better, that's going to start to bring more equity into the journey and then help people get through the journey with a little bit more information, guidance, direction, and hopefully to a baby quicker and with less of a burden. So those are the two.
The
number of male fertility, the male fertility is just increasing, and we need much better diagnostics and therapeutics in this space. And I'm hoping sperm QT that we are offering, I know it will add a significant value, but we need to keep putting research money and education in the field.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I saw that number earlier this week about like worldwide 1 in 6. And I even had looked at the CDC, like for the United States. And I know with Resolve, you know, they say 1 in 8. I remember one of my professors asking, like, where did that 1 in 8 come from? I'm like, I actually don't know. You know, and I looked more into it, and it was like the National Family Growth Survey through CDC. And the numbers was from like 2006 to 2010. And I'm like, not that that's a long time ago, but like it's a while ago, you know, and they have newer data from 2015 to 2019. And it showed it was 19.4% had infertility of couples. And I'm like, so we're trying to do the math. I'm like, 19.4%, that's like what, 1/6? Between 1/5 and 1/6 of the nation.
Yep.
That seems like a lot. It was one in, goes from 1 in 8 to 1 in 6 now, like conservatively 1 in 6, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it is. And just something else to add is the more conversations we can have about it, the less stigma we can put on it. When people are going through infertility, they're feeling very alone. When men are considered infertile, I don't think they realize how common it is for male infertility. So I just, the more we talk about it, I think couples trying to conceive will start to realize that a lot of people are dealing with it and that they're not alone, and there's lots of resources out there. Because if you're doing it alone, it is, it's a struggle. It's a struggle. So I'm glad we're talking about it, and I appreciate your podcast to bring more attention to the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I think, you know, getting it on the front end of it, you know, getting it, because I always think about, we all know about diabetes, cardiovascular health, all the different things, we know about cancer, we know about all these different things. We don't have to learn about them through diagnosis. Why does that have to be for infertility? Like, why should we have to learn about infertility through our own diagnosis? You know, that next generation shouldn't have to learn about it, and like when they're going through it,
a great
provide
point.
Them the education. Really, yeah. You know, like,
well said.
Yeah, I just, you're not only providing the awareness, you're providing the awareness of her that 1 in 6 of their friends are probably going to go through it, or they themselves. Like, so you're providing awareness about one infertility, what those options are. You're increasing exposure to the field of reproductive medicine, whether whatever multidisciplinary part you're part of that, and you're also dispelling myths and anecdotal evidence about just relaxing to get, you know, it's like those things are like changing some of those things that we generationally have passed on and on that aren't true. So I think it's multiple reasons why like we should be doing this, and it's just about getting into some of those spaces and being able to present, whether that's at a conference or, I don't know, it's just like, I'm curious, but a lot of people have ideas, but I just think it's if we start there, like, then we can at least in the long game build awareness, you know, in the long term.
Absolutely. We'll keep on doing your work, and we'll keep on educating and
Well, it was awesome having you on here, and I really appreciate the discussion, and yeah, it was very informative, and yeah, it was awesome.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, this was great. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to the Miles Podcast.
Miles Podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com, and I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.